about the 34th verse in the next program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن می کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha
Imam Khomeini's opinion on religious democracy. With total pride, I would like to thank the honorable nation of Iran for their political development and Islamic commitment. At the end of my life, I shall migrate towards the blessed abode of the truth with total optimism and pride at your genius.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. We are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the election. Imam has said that if we are lax in elections, be sure they, the enemies, will render a blow to us through the Islamic Consultative Assembly or Majlis. And he says that my advice to the noble nation is to be on the scene and participate in the elections, whether for president or Majlis representatives. Elections for the experts to determine the leadership council or the leader. So basically here, Imam Khomeini is saying that if we become lazy in participating in elections, then the right that we have to choose a person, a perfect person, a noble person, a person who has taqwa, a person who has seen the oppression, who has tasted the hungerness, who has tasted being needy. It is the time in the election when there is a free election and you can choose amongst the candidates. Choose the one who you think who can lead the nation in the best way.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
Then there is a noble nation, definitely this noble nation will elect a noble person for themselves. They will elect a noble president in order to manage the country. So the participation in election is very important. And if people do not participate in election, then Imam Khomeini has said that be sure the enemies will render a blow to us through the Majlis, through the consultative assembly. So we need to be very much careful, because all these representatives,
which are coming. We need to know about them. If we do not participate, then those who do not have the right to become the candidates, who do not have the right to become the managers of the country, who do not have the right to run the country and Islamic State, they will take over. And then that will be the time when we couldn't do, when we will be able to not to do anything. So inshallah, may Allah give us tawfiq to understand the teachings of Quran and Ahlul Bayt and to follow it. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermon of the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are focusing on the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are discussing the sermon of the Qasi'ah, or the sermon which brings down, which degrades, or humiliates. Basically, why it's mentioned that, why it is called that, is because Imam Ali alayhi salam was to degrade pride, bring down pride, and remove it from the society. Especially because in the start, Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about the pride that Shaitan had, and how it is something that is dislikable in Islam. And in the previous session, we discussed about one of the important tenets that are there in an Islamic government, and that is that people need to take heed, the people of the Ummah, of the Islamic government or the Islamic Ummah, need to know and take heed of the different calamities or the punishments that happened to the previous generations, and see very carefully what led them to grow and what led them to digress, what led them to, let's say, fall into a regression and destruction and humiliation. What are those factors that led to that? And they are told to get hold of those good things and stay away from those bad things that caused them to get into destruction.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of peak of eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we discussed about this particular phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, فَإِذَا تَفَكَّرْتُمْ فِي تَفَاوُتِ حَالَيْهِمْ فَالْزَمُوا كُلَّ أَمْرٍ لَزِمَتِ الْعِزَّةُ بِهِ شَأْنَهُمْ. Imam alayhi salam says that when you ponder upon or you ponder into the differences in their states, that means you saw that once this community of people was very good, at another time this community of people of the Muslims became very bad. When you saw that these two things were happening, sometimes they were very good, sometimes they became very bad, sometimes they were very honorable, sometimes they became degraded, sometimes they were alhamdulillah wealthy and they lived a good life, but sometimes they became degraded by people, they had differences, they were disunited, they had terrorists, they had problems, all these difficulties happen to them. When you see this, then try to ponder upon what led them to be honorable and get hold of those things that made them honorable. And this tells us of a very important factor, and that is that there are certain set divine norms. There are certain set godly norms. We call them sunnat-e ilahi. There are certain godly rules and norms in the society, whereby these godly and divine norms, societal norms that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala applies in different situations of a society, are such that they recur. And therefore, if someone is aware of these norms, if he knows, for example, that this particular community, like the Bani Israel, let us say, because of, for example, forging the Book of God, because of interpolating the Book of God, because of destroying the teachings of Torah and adding their own teachings into them, they became degraded people, they become disliked people and despised by the people at that time. And therefore, they even ended up being a reason why the Prophet of God left them. Then we should see today also, we should look at ourselves today as a Muslim society. Those factors, those issues that they performed that time, if we too would perform at our time today, the same things will happen, because there are set divine norms for the society according to God. These set divine norms are repetitive, so be careful about them, take care of them, keep them in mind.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, according to the Quran and the teachings of the Quran, Quran teaches us that there are certain rules, just like the nature, the universe has got certain laws that govern the universe. Okay, there are the laws of motion, there are the laws of gravity. There are different laws and rules that govern the natural processes in the universe, right? Millions of stars, galaxies, right? The seas, the oceans, everything are governed by these rules. And some of them are very intricate. And they are also with regards to the tiniest entities that exist in the universe, the atoms. And everything have got these rules and laws, and they follow them precisely. In the same way, there are rules of the society, there are rules in the social arena, there are rules regarding how societies grow and how they fall, how they develop and how they how they become degraded. All of these things are governed by set principles. These set principles is what we call Sunan-e-Ilahi. In Arabic, we'd call them, of course, the same, the word Sunnah. sunnatun ilahiyya, right? The divine norms that are there, or the divine rules that exist in the society. This is so important to keep in mind, that even if thousands of years pass in an Islamic government or in an Islamic society or in a human society, these laws will never change. These laws will remain, and they will remain to affect the people. They will remain to affect the societies. So persons should not expect that these laws are there, for example, for the previous generations, and for our generations these laws do not apply. Rather, they apply and they are constant and dominant throughout time. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we are able to live in such a way that these laws create progress in our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد ممجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of Imam Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, both from the Islamic House of Qom. Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for inviting
You're
me.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So, June 18th, 2021 is the day that the presidential election is going to be held in Islamic Republic of Iran. And what is interesting is that in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the term republic refers to the role of the people in their own fate. One of the things which is very important in establishing the fate of the people in this country is voting for the president. And the interesting point about the voting system in Iran and the elections is that every vote is counted. It is in contrast to what's happening in the Western world, like electoral college, you know, votes or something like that, state votes or something like that. Every vote and every person can vote, you know, a person who is, that's right,
eligible.
Mature, eligible, 18 years old, isn't it?
Yeah.
18 years old, we can say can vote. And every 4 years, a new president is going to be elected as the president of Islamic Republic of Iran. The leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, in his latest speech very much emphasized on this Jumhuriya aspect, or the republic, or the people's role aspect of the elections, and the role that the people have in, we can say, discerning their own destiny and fate of the future of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Said Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother. So, you know, this type of election in Iran, how do you find it different from the other elections all across the world? You yourself had traveled to different countries, okay? And you know the models and the systems over there. What is the main difference between this one and the other ones in the other countries?
Well, if I want to just compare the presidential election,
yes,
with the other presidential elections in the world, because you know we have two types of elections, governance in the countries. One is the prime minister, where the people like choose ministers and then they choose a prime minister from amongst them. And then there is a presidential election that there are a couple of candidates who comes and they do their own campaign and everyone votes for them. When I compare the presidential election in Iran and the rest of the world, there are some good points about the Iranian presidential election.
That's right.
And one of them is that, you know, when a person has been elected, the rest are generally submissive to the decision. They respect the decision.
Okay.
Number two, people do believe that their votes are counted.
Mm-hmm.
Because generally in the other countries, we see that if someone is being elected, then these kind of things started, like the discussions that my vote wasn't counted, or there was a kind of, you know, we can say a fraud, or the person was pre-elected and these kind of things. Yes, in the anti-Iranian regime, we do see these things about Iran. But within Iran, we don't see such things within Iran. Yes,
right.
The media, which is propagating against the Islamic Republic of Iran, yes, they talk about all these things, but that is not the criteria
mm-hmm.
to see. It's the general public.
Okay.
And when people choose someone, obviously, they know that. When they vote someone, they know that it's been their vote. And the way they participate with the energy which they have, generally, you know, when it is election, they show from the morning, like the show starts from the morning on
yes.
the TV.
This time is 7 in the morning till 2 at night. At mm-hmm. night.
Yeah, midnight. It's sometimes
midnight.
It's midnight.
Because of the coronavirus, you know, the time is extended in order, we can say, people...
To prevent people staying in lines.
Yeah, staying in lines or big lines, you know.
Too close to
yeah.
each other.
Yeah.
So we can see, you know, a big public
yes.
queued in the line for the elections.
Yes.
Sometimes we've seen families, you know, generally people just go and vote and come back.
Mm-hmm.
Here we see families, small
yes.
kids,
yes.
they're with the parents.
Okay.
And the parents are teaching how to do this.
Yes.
So this is very important. And this thing shows that, you know, when it is said it's a religious obligation upon them to select a true manager for themselves, they're really doing it. And on the other hand, there is another view which I've seen in the people of Iran, and that is when we ask them, like, why you've gone for voting, for example, they say it is an obligation upon us, number one. Number two, it's we want to basically show our enemies
mm-hmm.
that this is our power.
That's right.
This is us.
Mm-hmm.
That if you say that there is a need of change of regime in Iran, in the elections we come and we show that there is no need of change in the regime.
That's right.
We are here, we are present here with the maximum number of people participating in elections
okay.
to show that the majority of people do not want any change in the regime.
That's
and that's
right.
what we can see. You can see also in the Western media, or the media which is which is doing propaganda against Iran, that they're talking about. For example, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we had this election in Syria.
Yes.
The Bashar Assad,
yes.
he won with the 90% of, you know, votes.
Yes.
And that was a big victory for Syria, because, you know, the Western powers, they're talking about the change of the regime in Syria, and then the people of Syria, they showed that we do not want any kind of change.
Mm-hmm. So it means that election actually brings immunity to the system and the states.
Yes.
And elections, presidential elections in Iran is a guarantee to the whole system. I think to the Islamic revolution of Iran, a kind of confirmation for that. But the case is that, you know, somehow, even inside Iran, the people are comparing the presidential election to the Western models, and I think that the Western model is not applicable in Iran, because it, you know,
if they're comparing based on democracy
mm-hmm. and based on the free liberal capitalism, they have their own models, but Iran is not successful.
The main problem is people do not know about the election system of the West.
West, that's right.
You know, for example, in France, if there is a presidential election, there is a committee.
Yes.
There is a council.
Yes.
Who checks the ability of candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I think, 6 or 9 people. Like, every president who's been president, ex-president, is part of that council. And other than that, there are like 3 other people who have been selected. So these are the people who basically check the, you know, eligibility of these candidates.
That's right.
And if the candidate has such abilities, or he is eligible, he fulfills the conditions, then he's allowed to participate in the election. Same is the case in Iran. We have the Guardianship Council, who checks the eligibility of the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when we want to have like election, like as in West, there are certain points, but that is not highlighted in the news from themselves, like from the Western media, we can say. In Iran, because everything is Islamic, and obviously this is very important, that a person who wants to become a candidate should be eligible, should be, for example, you know, his zahir, his apparent, should be, you know, someone who's following the Islamic laws, and he's submissive to that. He respects it. He has other conditions as well that are mentioned in the constitution.
Yes.
So you should fulfill that.
Okay.
Because it's Islamic, so in Iran everything has been highlighted, from the guardianship council to the level, like when they have a week or two for, you know,
for
appeal.
Campaigns,
for appeal, and after that is a time of campaign, and there are like dialogues and all those debates and all those.
That's right.
So because everything is being made apparent in Iran, that's why maybe some of people in Iran, because they're unaware of what's happening in the West, that's why they might say like, we want the system as in the West. Whereas if you bring the Western system, then the candidates will be lesser than what you have right now in the elections.
I think, and this is not the point, because, you know, even in the West itself, I think there are some differences between, for example, the UK and the US, okay?
UK is a prime minister.
And also the other European
minister.
Countries.
No,
yes.
In UK we have a prime minister.
Yes, I know, and the other European countries. Yeah. But, you know, an Eastern country, a Muslim land, has its own system.
Yes.
And the good point about Islamic, this type of election, is that it could be a role model also for other Muslim countries.
Yes, definitely.
This could be a role model, we can say, and a new model that observes Islam and keeps track on the path of Islam. At the same time, the people's votes are counted, because some people say that when you have the system of velayat-e-faqih, what is the role of the people? But they don't know that, you know, this velayat-e-faqih that we have now, Ayatollah Khamenei, here and there, on different occasions, has emphasized on the role of the people, that they might have, we can say, in establishing their own
it's
future.
Very important that velayat-e-faqih himself is involving people in the decisions.
Yes.
So that tomorrow, if something is happening, you know, it's very easy to blame one person and say, like, it's because of you. But when we are involved in such a decision, then it's very hard to do that.
Okay.
We cannot back up from the
things
that we have, the decisions that we made. We cannot back.
Yes.
So it's very important, and it's also a good way of, you know, ruling or governing a place, so that everyone is involved.
And we are, I think, somehow, how can I say, we are unexperienced, because 40 years have passed the Islamic Revolution of Iran. People are still in the process of tests and trials, okay? So day by day, and, you know, president after president, we will get to the high qualified president that would be approved by an Islamic system. This is, I think, natural and normal.
I just remembered when you said 40 years, you know, in some of the narrations we have, the man's mental maturity
or
intellectual maturity comes after 40 years.
Yeah.
So these 40 years, the things that happened in Iran, the president election and the presidents that you had, now some kind of maturity has come in the people, inshallah.
Yeah, and but I think, again, that portraying the people's participation, you know, every 4 years when the presidential election is held in Iran, the foreign press are over here. They have conferences over here, okay? So they are recording the people's participation in the votes and the voting system and the votes, you know, on the polling stations. But the case is that when they get back to their own media, a different picture is shown to the people. For example, the decisions that have been made before selecting the candidates who are going to be the president of Islamic Republic of Iran. And this media, I think, has influenced the people inside Iran too, somehow. I do want to say, again, getting back to this Ahad-e Millat, that, you know, when we say this Ahad-e Millat, I mean every person among the nation has a vote, okay?
Yeah.
And this vote is respected. But some criticisms are made by the Western media that before holding the elections, these votes are clear. And I think controlling the mechanism of the voting stations and the voting system is something which is done by Islamic Republic of Iran. Do you accept this criticism, brother?
It's a wrong, impression that actually they want to put in the minds of the people through their media empire that they are actually always active over the Iranian people and Iranian nation.
Right.
But here we clearly see that people are free in their votings, and they actually find it as their own right to vote whenever they are interested. And there is no sort of prevention from the government or pressure from the government to ask a group and to vote and not to vote. So we see it, but the picture and image that they are actually making from the Islamic Republic is something that is twisted, and everyone, at least inside the country, know that. But since they are more active in the media, so they usually and naturally propagate what they believe in. But we see that much elections that we have had in our country can really be seen in the most developed and, let's say, as they claim, the most democratic countries as well. So more than 40 elections in almost 42 years is something surprising.
Even the villages in Iran and the rural areas,
even
the navies on the sea, and you know,
we have heard from the candidates.
We have
heard from the candidates of presidential election that we send helicopters to take the villagers' votes.
That's why we do that.
Yeah, this is what is being done here. I don't know if the same procedure and process is being practiced overseas in all these countries, that they're actually their voice of equality and justice has deafened the whole world. I don't know if it is being practiced, but here this is what we do. Once, let's say 10 years ago, actually I was involved in the election process, and I see how difficult it is for those who are going to the villages to collect the votes of the people. And usually people are totally free to vote for whoever they like.
That's all right. And the mosque as the polling centers for Iran, you know, in Iran's system of polling station, that they select the mosques in neighborhoods in order to go there and vote for the president. This is really beautiful, you know, makes the mosque again as the societal and the social role that the mosque may have in adhering and showing the people together. This is really
very
beautiful.
Yeah.
What is
These are
happening.
Beautiful scenes that we can see in the elections. Mosques and what we call them Husseiniyas, the places that people gather for Islamic assemblies. These are the places usually.
Also, the gathering between the young people, you know, in the presidential elections before that, before coronavirus, I mean, the previous rounds of presidential election, usually the young people used to chit chat and debate inside the mosques. After the prayers, sitting together, talking about different candidates from two opposing sides, and about their plans, and this is really beautiful. Okay, thank you much, Brother Adir Abiyan and Said Mohsen Nawi, for your nice elaboration regarding the role of the people in establishing their own future through presidential election. Iranian presidential election this year is held on June 18, 2021, and the people of Iran, inshallah, will participate in this big, we can say, political scene of Islamic Republic of Iran. This was what we tackled through the speeches and the thoughts of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the program Viewpoints. Dear listeners, you can visit our website and this program, other episodes of this program, at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page under the title Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the lives of Rohingya people in Myanmar against the backdrop of the crippling pandemic as well as a military coup. And we shall take a look at the economic growth in Bangladesh and its prospective climb up the ladder of global trade and Asian geopolitics.
While Rohingya people are being relocated to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, prone to floods and cyclones, life is getting harder and harder for this Muslim minority community due to the deadly pandemic in their camps, as well as fires and violent Buddhist extremists rampaging their lives. Condemning the relocation, the United Nations and other rights groups have expressed concerns about the safety of the persecuted refugees, as well as their volition. Authorities say they only send those who have volunteered, but the Rohingyas say they are being coerced.
Back in the time when the whole subcontinent was one entity under the British colonial rules, a lot of people used to move back and forth throughout the whole region without restrictions. But the World War II messed up the situation. The Rohingya were allied with the British and wanted their areas to be part of Bangladesh, then called East Pakistan. But Burma had an alliance with the Japanese invaders, hoping to topple the British rule. Thus were born the roots of the enmity. When the Burmese won the war and gained independence, they wanted to get rid of the Rohingyas since they saw them as illegal Bangladeshi immigrants in their country, or the remnants of its British colonial past. More than 130 distinct ethnic groups live in Myanmar, with the largest minorities having their own states under the Panglong Agreement in 1947. But the Rohingyas, even at over a million in population then, were not recognized, and they have been denied citizenship since the country's independence. To make it impossible for the Rohingyas to live there, Myanmar created a legal vicious circle. Under the country's citizenship law of 1982, only members of ethnic groups that settled within Myanmar prior to 1823 are eligible for automatic citizenship. And if they have descendants that enter the country before 1948, they can apply for naturalization if they can submit evidence and documentation. But most of the Rohingyas, who have been living in the area for centuries, don't have the proper paperwork because the country didn't allow them to.
The complex Rohingya refugee crisis aggravated in August 2017 following some small-scale attacks on remote police outposts in western Myanmar by armed groups allegedly belonging to the community. This was a pretext for the following systematic assaults against the Muslim minority, which human rights groups, including senior UN officials, have said amounted to ethnic cleansing. More than 700,000 Rohingyas escaped the genocide by Myanmar's military with little more than the clothes on their backs and joined 300,000 people already in camps in Bangladesh in 2017. Attempts at repatriation of the Rohingyas to Myanmar have failed because these stateless people, who have seen their villages burnt and wives raped by the Buddhist extremists and the military, were too fearful of further violence to return.
The COVID-19 pandemic has added to the miseries of the persecuted community. Due to lockdowns, most of these people have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity while hunger and poverty loom over the community. In recent weeks, dozens of Rohingyas, including children, developed COVID-like symptoms, but their camps lack testing facilities, and the community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. The spread of the virus is unavoidable in the camps because their makeshift shanties lean on each other and there is absolutely no support programs for food, sanitation or health care. As the virus keeps raging across the camps, they had to resort to home remedies and self-quarantine, but the destitute minority is getting closer to another humanitarian disaster if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Ali Johar, co-director of Rohingya Human Rights Initiative. First of all, I would like to thank Mr. Johar for being on the program and ask him to walk us through the crisis that has plagued the Rohingya Muslims for decades and why they are persecuted.
Thank you so much for having me here. Actually, this question is should be for the persecutors, not to the persecuted. But what I can explain to you is what actually has been happening with the Rohingyas since decades. So from the beginning, I may start from 1942 when, around 200,000 Rohingyas had to flee the country in a first, violent attack. And then in 1975, 15,000 Rohingya had to flee. In 1977, an operation called Operation Nagema, which is clearly a racial, attacks on the minorities. So this attack was, by the military to clear the what they call so-called foreign nationals. In 1978, another military operation led to 200,000 Rohingya Muslims flee from their homelands. In 1982, military amended the constitution that talks about three categorical citizenship, where one is for the indigenous people, other one is for the naturalized, another one is for the descendants of the mixed population. So in this indigenous category, Rohingyas have been excluded since then. No Rohingyas have been allowed to hold any public offices. In 1990, NLD won the general election, which was clearly ignored by the military. And in 1991, again, more than 200,000, around 250,000 Rohingyas have to flee because of they were, you know, they were used as forced labor. Our women have been used as sex slaves by the military and raped, and because of the religious persecution as well. In between 2004 to 1997 to 2004, around 230,000 refugees were repatriated under a deal by United Nations. But this kind of violent attack continuously, took place since military started its dictatorship, which has, ended up in a very most horrific experience of the Rohingya in their lifetime in 2016 and 17, leading more than 750,000 people fleeing to Bangladesh, joining exodus there. You know, it's been reported that almost 10,000 women have been raped. You know, thousands have been killed.
How has the situation changed since the coup d'etat in Myanmar? And is life any different for the Rohingyas who control the country?
You know, Rohingya have been facing decade-long persecution under the military rule. Whoever rules the country, the minorities have been, at the end of receiving the violent crackdown. Since the coup took place, all the attention was on the, rehabilitating the genocide survivors, that is Rohingyas. But after the coup took place, this entire world attention have been shifted to, towards human rights violation in the larger picture. So the process that have been initiated to rehabilitate the Rohingyas to actually go back to their homelands, and the Rohingyas who are hopeful to, return to their homes very soon have become, a delayed process. So as we were already in a confined situation, the coup has brought, more worse situation for us, because it is the military which has been, persecuting us, and it is again the same military government there now. So the coup has, brought a devastation for Rohingyas. But there is a change in the, general public minds, because the military has, manipulated the situation of Rohingyas by misinforming the general public. That it is because of the Rohingyas, it is themselves they are creating the situation in Rakhine State. The military does flying with the rule of law, but now the general public is realizing that they have been misinformed. That the general public has been, used as a campaign against the Rohingyas. So now there is a shift in the understanding of the general public that we were actually misinformed. In fact, we were used in the persecution of the Rohingya Muslims.
Thank you, Mr. Johar, for being on the program. And now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Remove the Fence has portrayed a grim but normal scene in the lives of kids from the minority community. RYMGMGSA has pointed out one of the particular problems of living in camps. Rain is no longer a blessing when you have no roof. Rohingya Girls Matter has touched upon yet another ugly truth about their ordeal, an hour-long line for a sip of water. Taqiya Azam has talked about the situation of coronavirus spread across their refugee camp. tells the story of a Rohingya man who has been tortured by Myanmar's military. He is Rohingya refugee living in Bangladesh camps.
Put hand policing and what a leader gives them this country people is the Rohingya. Coming to Bangladesh, Balukali came 11, 15 because and family very, very dangerous, very, very serious son and family and no rice, no quality, no water. Now relief, now money in gift, and very dangerous, very big problem. But oh, there was cancer.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Since the COVID pandemic has hit the world, the economies of many countries have contracted significantly. But an Asian country, not known for its economic resilience, is doing surprisingly well. Emerging as a new rising star, Bangladesh even managed to leave India and Pakistan behind in terms of per capita income. Moreover, the country is now amongst those countries that helped India in the devastating new wave of the COVID pandemic.
As one of the emerging economies of South Asia, Bangladesh has seen significant economic growth during the past decades and is seemingly set to become the next economic superstar in Asia. With nearly 10% rise in per capita income for the year 2020 to 2021, Bangladesh has surpassed India and Pakistan with an estimated $2,227. As a result of higher than expected remittance flows, the World Bank has revised Bangladesh's GDP growth from an earlier prediction of 1.7% to 3.6%. When Bangladesh announced its independence from Pakistan in early 1970s, the newborn state was struggling with war, famine, and mass exodus. A large number of Bangladeshi people were killed on their way to Pakistan and India that were the richer and stronger countries back then. But now the landscape of the country seems far more prosperous than the rest of the countries in the subcontinent. Now it is Bangladesh that is helping others. Bangladesh has agreed to provide a currency swap of $200 million to Sri Lanka for a period of 3 months. Moreover, Bangladesh is also amongst the 40 states which provided assistance to India during the devastating second wave of the pandemic. The South Asian nation provided India with over 10,000 vials of remdesivir, as well as PPE kits, zinc, calcium, vitamin C, and other tablets. Once believed to be so destitute that illegal migrants from there kept overrunning the neighboring borders, Bangladesh is now way happier and richer than most of the countries of the subcontinent.
Back in the 70s, some believed that the new country seemed destined to fail. Henry Kissinger, then Secretary of State, famously called it a basket case. However, recent developments proved otherwise, as the growing importance of Bangladesh is not just limited to the context of South Asia, but the whole world. In addition to remittances flow, a large portion of Bangladesh's GDP is from the garment industry, with overcrowded factories and substandard conditions. If Bangladesh seeks to sustain its growth and become an economic powerhouse, it should recognize and address its vulnerabilities.
Upon creation, Bangladesh started its economic trail with implementation of socialist policies and nationalized the majority of its corporations. It was not the right way and decreased industrial production near to zero. Therefore, the government gradually revised the policies and returned state-owned enterprises to the private sector. The reforms raised the contribution of industrial sector to the GDP, thus accelerating the growth in industrial and service sectors. With a massive labor force that is among the top 10 across the globe, today Bangladesh is one of the largest garment manufacturers of the world. The sector accounts for over 84% of the country's total exports and provides employment to more than 4 million workers. In addition, the country's service sector is now the largest contributor to their GDP and employment. Another factor behind the growth is the remittance by the diaspora. In 2019, about 10 million Bangladeshi migrants sent home over $18 billion. This is nearly 7% of the total GDP of the nation and has created a steady flow of foreign currency to the country. To keep up the growth, Bangladesh faces numerous challenges too. The manufacturing is not properly diversified, and depending so much on one single industry can have its own caveats. Despite the growth, Bangladesh witnessed a 20% decrease in foreign direct investment last year, and over-dependence on remittance can adversely affect the domestic production.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Dr. Ahsan Mansoor, Executive Director of Policy Research Institute of Bangladesh and Chairman of BRAC Bank. Now, Mr. Ahsan, welcome to the show. During the COVID pandemic, the economies of many countries have contracted. How come Bangladesh's economy did not shrink?
Well, that's a very good question, because we think that economy expanded, it didn't shrink, but it slowed down quite a bit. We are growing at 7% plus rate, so it came down significantly because of COVID. Primarily, our several sectors was not much impacted. Agriculture was completely outside the COVID, so, and they had a very good output. So agriculture sector was completely intact and growing. Other than the urban centers, most of the rural area was untouched. For all practical purpose, there was not much of an impact there of the COVID. So urban centers were shut out, and that, and so industries were impacted, but they recovered. The large industries recovered very fast. In fact, many of them did not, even the bank that I am chairing, we didn't have any big loss or anything. Our profitability was the same as before. So it shows that it's an indication that the economy was pretty robust in many ways. So I think agriculture plus large industries coming back very fast, the small ones have been impacted significantly. And some of the service sector activities were impacted initially, but then they rebounded very fast because construction and other small service sectors, including retail, this, that, they recovered very fast. So overall, growth slowed down, but it was not negative.
How did Bangladesh manage to leave India and Pakistan behind in per capita income, and what are some of the factors behind this growth?
Okay, yeah. You see, Bangladesh has been growing very steadily in the last 30, 40 years. In the 80s, our growth rate was 3%. In the 90s, it was 4%. In the 2000, it was 5%. And then in 2000, it was 6%. And then it was 7%. And it touched 8%, but it didn't sustain because of COVID. So that's one part of it. Why it is growing steadily is in part because of, we do invest a respectable amount, about 30% of GDP is investment every year in the economy. That's a sizable amount. Plus, we have a real strong macroeconomic stability. We never had very large fluctuations in the exchange rates and so on, unlike Pakistan, India, and many other emerging countries, middle-income countries. So our exchange rate is very stable. And compared to India, our exchange rate in the last two decades probably appreciated by about 40%. 50%, our currency vis-a-vis India. And vis-a-vis Pakistan, our currency is appreciated by more than 100%. So, and that exchange rate factor is plays a role in the dollar conversion to comparison purpose. So Indian per capita income didn't grow as much because of the currency depreciation than Bangladesh, Bangladesh stability and so on. And we also have a stable inflation, about 5% or so. So everything taken together, it's a good environment, macro environment. Balance of payment has always been very strong, and our reserve position is very strong. We have, for our needs, we have $45 billion, which is our 10 months of import cover for us.